You are listening to our annual Spokane Public Radio Health Forum Suicide Awareness. And we're starting to get some questions from the audience. I'm going to jump into those in a few minutes, but I want to interview at least one more of our panelists because we haven't had a real chance to talk. We want to take a totally different aspect on the topic of taking one's own life right now. In Washington State, voters approved an initiative that allows terminally ill patients the right to end their own lives. They call it the Death with Dignity Act. And we have Arlene Hinckley with us from the group End of Life Washington. Arlene, talk a little bit about Washington's Death with Dignity Act. I mean, how does it work specifically?
The act was voted on by the public and passed with almost 58% of the vote throughout the state. It went into effect in March of 2009. To qualify for the law, to be able to request and use medication, you must be a terminally ill, that is with a prognosis of 6 months or less, adult resident of Washington. Most importantly, you must be able to self-ingest the medication. That's the voluntary part of the act. There's a somewhat complicated qualification process in that a person has to see two physicians. One, the attending physician or prescribing physician, whom they have to see twice, make oral requests. A consulting physician confirms the diagnosis, prognosis, and competency. They must make a written request. There are waiting periods built into this process, so hasty decisions are not made. There's at least 15 days of waiting between all of these requests. So that's basically how the law works.
Do you have any figures of how many people have opted to use this since it went in? You said it started in 2009. Do we have any figures for the last year or any of that nature off the top of your head?
The health department is responsible for compiling all the statistics. All the participants, the doctors and so forth, have extensive paperwork that's sent to the health department. Unfortunately, they're not prompt in getting out the information, but we do have the information for 2015.
Okay.
And in that year, it actually consistently has worked out to be a very small number. Last 2015, it was 0.3% of all the deaths in Washington, so 0.3%. About 165 people used medication in 2015. There's been a slow but steady increase in the number of people using the law, I think in great part due to people becoming more aware of the law and medical providers being more willing to participate.
How many states have enacted similar laws? It's several, right?
There are five states at this point. Washington and Oregon by initiative, California and Vermont through the state legislatures, and Montana through the court system.
Okay. Now, you wanted to talk a little bit about the difference between what you call aid in dying and suicide, to make a distinction mm-hmm. on that, correct?
Right, right. When I speak about End of Life Washington or Death with Dignity, I do not use the word suicide. And in fact, the law specifically says this shall not constitute suicide, euthanasia, mercy killing. There's a profound difference in the reasoning between a person requesting aid in dying and a person contemplating or completing suicide. Suicide, and Cheryl mentioned the stigma attached to that word in our culture. Suicide is an action done by a person who is most often physically healthy, but they want to die. It's a decision made alone. It's often violent. It's a solitary act. Request for aid in dying is a rational, long thought out decision made by a person who would rather live if they could, but they can't. They, by definition, they're terminally ill. It's a decision that's made in consultation with family, physician, clergy, their God, if they have such beliefs. It's a decision made in harmony with values. It's not violent, and it's carried out in the presence of loved ones. So there is a significant difference. And multiple professional organizations, hospice and palliative care association, public health association, agree that suicide is not the proper word in this situation. So I encourage people to use aid in dying, physician aid in dying, planned death, or some version of that rather than the word suicide.
Tell us a little bit more then about your own organization, End of Life Washington. What services do you provide?
End of Life Washington is a small nonprofit. We provide a lot of education around advance directives and so forth, but I think the heart of our organization is to educate people about what options they have as they are approaching death. So we talk about all the options. We have about 35 volunteers throughout the state who work one-on-one with people wanting information and with their families. We talk about all the options they have. We have no vested interest in them using the Death with Dignity law. But if they do choose to use the law, we help them work their way through that complicated qualification process. Sometimes their own physicians are unwilling to participate in the law, and we can help them find physicians who will participate. So we cover the entire state, and there is no charge for our services.
Now, you recently participated in a hearing in Olympia about some proposal to change the law somewhat for the requirement for visiting physicians. Could you update us on what was the proposal and what was the end result with that?
The proposal was heard in the Senate Law and Judiciary Committee. The goal was to add language to the responsibilities of the prescribing physician to say that physician must discuss further treatment and the potential for cure with the person who is requesting this. We testified against it because it seems cruel to talk to somebody who has a 6-month prognosis about cure when there is no cure. And people who request aid in dying have gone through multiple rounds of all kinds of treatment, and there is no treatment left. So the bill was voted out of committee and passed in the Senate. It's now in the House, and it's dead-ended there. It's essentially dead. That committee is not going to hear it.
Okay.
So there are always people who want to change the law, to weaken the law. So we're kind of, we consider ourselves stewards of the Death with Dignity law. We want to make sure it's administered properly and the will of the voters is respected.
Let me just ask you too, we talked about this in the green room, the Supreme Court nominee that had his long 10-hour hearing today apparently has written a book specifically mentioning this type of aid in dying and apparently was against it. Do you have any concerns about that, what that could spell for our states in the future, or?
I do. I think it's the same issue as women's right to choose. It's the nominee, Mr. Gorsuch, does have strong feelings against death with dignity, which he calls suicide. And I think that the five states that have the law are in jeopardy if he's the nominee and a death with dignity law or case comes before the Supreme Court.
Okay. I want to do a follow-up with either Kevin or Stacy on your specific law and just ask for clarification. Is this a dilemma for counselors? In other words, do you find yourselves in a position where you'd have to tell someone in terrible pain, either physical or mental, that life in such pain is better than death? Or is that a moot point given the way this law is crafted?
Well, I'm not an expert in assisted death, but I respect the people that are, and I respect that the crafters of the law have been very diligent in their efforts to make sure that medical providers are involved and deal with issues of competency and in that probably mental health, just to make sure that this is not an undiagnosed mental illness that is influencing the patient's decision. So I have not worked with patients that are in the process of terminating their lives because of unbearable terminal illness. I do work in a medical facility, so I work with many patients who are in the throes of unbearable, seemingly unbearable medical conditions and treatment. Periodically, they will want to discuss issues related to their condition as they fear it to be the terminal. But I don't see that. I see them prior to the time when they're dealing with these kinds of decisions that you've just heard about.
Steve, may I add one thing? One of the things that our volunteers do, and I'm one of the volunteers who works directly with terminally ill people, my priority is first pain control. And we do encounter people who have severe pain, and it's not well controlled. We have wonderful pain control, but it's generally acknowledged that about 5% of pain cannot be well controlled short of putting the person into a coma. So we work very hard to make sure that the request is not because of untreated pain.
Okay, Stacy, did you want to add something to that at all, or?
You know, I can just add a little bit. It's kind of the same situation where the law really is diligent about making sure that this isn't something, this decision is not driven from, say, someone's depression or some other mental disorder that is influencing a decision to live or not. And so it would be very rare. In fact, I've never had it happen where someone that was going down this path then ended up in my world, in the kind of the mental health section of it. And if that were to be the case, they would not qualify for death with dignity because there would be a treatment need. And then as with people who have suicidal ideation, when they receive treatment, oftentimes that ideation does go away. It gets better, it improves, and maybe they don't have that ever again. Maybe they do, but it would move them out of this different path.
Okay. And I've got questions that we're going to address to our sub-panelists down here at the table in just a few minutes, but I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to start pulling from the pile of some of our audience questions and throw some of those out first, and then we'll also offer opportunities if someone actually wants to get up and ask a question. We'll do that in a few minutes, too. Now, I don't know if anybody has answers to this one, but this is an audience question. San Francisco is taking steps to stop suicides on the Golden Gate Bridge. Seattle has apparently done the same kind of thing for the Aurora Bridge. What steps can we in Spokane take to stop suicides on Monroe Street Bridge? I don't know if you may be not the most qualified people to be asking this. Might be a question for city government, but do you want to weigh in on that at all? Do you have any expertise, or is this not an appropriate question?
I can speak a little bit to
that. Great.
For those of you that aren't aware, we actually do have a suicide coalition here in Spokane County. They meet, I think, every other month on Friday afternoons. And some of their projects and initiatives have been around means restrictions, which include looking at our bridges and what we can do to kind of address, you know, and model what some of these other places are doing. And so if you're interested in that and want to know more about that, that would be a great opportunity for you guys to attend. It's an open meeting. Anyone can come. And I can probably get information maybe to you on when the next meeting is.
Okay. Great. And that could even be a follow-up news story that I could work on, too, maybe with the city, too. So, you know, maybe keep in touch with me. Okay, here's the kind of question I anticipate we might get, and this is some pretty heavy stuff. So it says, I live with major depression, anxiety, PTSD, and OCD. I consider these terminal in the fact that major depression overwhelms me emotionally, physically, every day. The medications I take for major depression, I believe, is why I am alive. However, I feel so sad. Just going through the motions of life, I feel and believe most of the time that I do not have anyone to live for. Quality of life has really decreased in the last 7 years. Why should I be forced to live? So this is for the group, if you guys can provide some answers to this person. Kevin?
I would love to talk with you after the meeting. I would love to do that. And beyond that, I would just say that there are people in this room tonight who have the ability and the desire to listen to you and to just listen to your suffering. And through that process, assist you. You feel isolated and you feel alone. And those are two terrible experiences, apart from even all of the other terrible struggles that you deal with. And so I think that my response would be, I think I hear what you're saying. I know I do. And if you would like to talk after the meeting, we can do that. I'd love to do that. And like I say, there are a lot of people in this room that would be willing to listen as well.
I think we could facilitate that. If that person who wrote that would want to kind of hang near the end and maybe try to find Nisha and the gal that was taking the cards and maybe say, hey, can I talk to Dr. Hyde? If you can do that, that would be great. And we appreciate you leaving that question.
Can I add to that too?
You bet.
I just wanted to thank whoever did write that for the courage to bring that forward. I see that also as an ask for help. And if for some reason you're not comfortable, you know, talking with someone tonight in person, to please consider either calling myself, or I'm sure that would be an option for Dr. Hyde as well, or calling our crisis line. The other thing I would say is, that is a long time to have that pain and suffering. And my experience has shown that people in similar situations that have tried medication after medication, counselor after counselor, it gets to a point where you are at that point, like, what is the point? And what I can share with you is that sometimes it's that very next person that you reach out to that has some sort of positive impact on you that can completely change your world around. And so what I would offer is that you please take advantage of that next person that you talk to, whether it's Dr. Hyde or myself or someone from the crisis line.
Great, thanks. And again, we've got quite a few questions here, so this is good. And hopefully we can, if, like you had said, Scott, earlier tonight, if we could just help one person tonight, I think we've done a good job. So hopefully we can at least provide some comfort to someone. Here's another touching one. It says, what is the first thing a 12-year-old should say or do to another 12-year-old who is contemplating suicide? Anyone?
What's the first thing they should say?
Yeah, it says, what is the first thing they should say or do?
Well, first thing would be at any age to come alongside that person and be that ear and to listen. If that 12-year-old probably feels alone, that 12-year-old probably feels rejected, that 12-year-old might be quite surprised that there's someone that's willing to say, I want to try to help you. Yeah, I think that would be important.
Do you think that they would be, you know, delighted is not the right word, but welcoming someone that's their own age that's trying to help them rather
sure.
than maybe a parent to start
sure.
with?
A peer, yeah.
But then the follow-up would be, should they then be trying, the other, you know, the person looking for help should be trying to connect them with a counselor or something.
Yeah, right? That would be the second step.
Yeah.
And it would be a pretty courageous kid that would be willing to say, yes, let's talk. That would be a pretty courageous kid. But you ask, well, what I think should happen, that would be my first thought. You know, suicide is difficult for people in the medical profession to talk about, let alone a 12-year-old kid. You know, things move quite quickly in a medical center, even in an emergency department. And so frequently, we think a person is fine, and we don't ask the question, are you feeling like taking your own life? Just being asked the question can be hugely important. Whatever age the person is, whatever condition individual's in, can be hugely important. So yeah, it's courageous for the 12-year-old kid to be able to say, you know, I'd like to listen to you, I'd like to talk. It's courageous for the medical professional to say, are you feeling like taking your life?
Stacey,
it's difficult.
Did you want to add?
Yeah, I would add to that. I think oftentimes kids will share with their friends, but then they'll say things like, don't tell anyone. And unfortunately, that kid then won't tell anyone because they want to keep that confidentiality. And so what we tell parents is, please talk to your kids and make sure they understand that if they do hear something like this, that they do listen, they do try and align with that individual, but they do need to, you know, look for an adult that they trust, because they have to take that step. And it's, you know, suicide, completed suicides with our younger youth, it's a problem. It's not our, you know, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds. It's our younger people as well. And I remember hearing this one gentleman talk. He had lost his 12-year-old son to suicide. And what he said was, you know, we talk to our kids about sex and drugs, and we don't talk to them about suicide. And that was really meaningful, because that's true. And I think that parents talking to their kids, even if there isn't a concern about suicide, is still a positive step, because then they can talk to their kids about, if you have a friend that is experiencing this, find out who a trusting adult is and get that information to them.
Chris, come on up here, because I just realized this is the perfect opportunity to talk to you. So Chris Moore is with District 81. And what is your official title again?
I'm a coordinator in student services.
Okay, and you wanted to add something to that, and then I had a whole line of questions about just the district, but.
My response to that question is, please tell that 12-year-old to go share that, break any promise that you've made. That is the one promise that is always okay to break, and you go to the school counselor. Whether or not the child wants you to share or not, you go to that school counselor. All of our school counselors in Spokane Public Schools, Meade, Cheney, East Valley, West Valley, every school counselor has been trained in suicide prevention. It's not something that a 12-year-old should burden themselves in keeping. They need to take it to a trusted adult, Stacy, but also those school counselors. All of the nurses are trained. Our mental health therapists are trained. School psychologists are trained. But those school counselors, they're on the front lines, and they can provide that intervention.
And that was exactly the line of questions I had, but my questions were kind of basic. But so I guess is that a common thing for you to get tips from other students about possible suicidal students?
Absolutely. I as a former high school counselor myself, I would get those often. Middle school counselors are getting them. Elementary counselors are getting them. It is, as Stacy alluded to, this is not just something with our teenagers. This is students elementary and beyond. And we need to be courageous and talk to our kids about suicide. Just as those of us raised in the 60s, 70s, when sex was the terrible word and we didn't want to talk to our children about sex because then we would run out and do it. That was inaccurate. We didn't run out and have sex. And if we talk to our kids about suicide, they will not now turn to suicide as a coping mechanism. We need to have it not be so taboo. It's us keeping it taboo that's keeping it to themselves, and they're afraid of asking for help.
And that's one of the rumors that we talked about too, that talking about it isn't necessarily something that's going to prompt someone to do it.
Absolutely not. There is no research to correlate that in any fashion.
All right. Talk just a bit then about how the school district is kind of prepared to deal with suicide. I mean, do we have a number of counselors? I mean, how many do we have? Or just give me the basics on that, perhaps.
Well, every elementary school has at least one counselor. We have mental health therapists in almost every single building in Spokane Public Schools. Every middle school has two counselors. Every high school, we have anywhere from 4 to 6 counselors on staff. And as I said before, they're highly trained in suicide prevention. There's a lot of support.
Do you feel like you have enough resources from the state right now for that, or have there been requests for maybe more counselors or that type of
I think, as I was sharing with my panelists down there, we need more support around mental health therapy in our schools. We are seeing more and more kiddos that are suffering from depression, ADHD, they're on the spectrum, they are suffering from a plethora of mental health issues, and we absolutely need more support in our schools around mental health support for kids.
Has the school district put in actual requests to the state for that type of thing?
We have. That's ongoing work that we're always working on in Spokane Public Schools. We have brought on additional mental health therapists even this year alone. We have grown with the need, and the district values this, and we have a close collaboration with the county, and there's a team of people that this is addressed very regularly.
Okay. This is kind of slightly off topic and not necessarily directed at you, but it was something I'd seen in the paper in the Spokesman just in the last 2 weeks, so I thought I'd just at least throw this news blurb out, and if you guys wanted to react. And so this is for Chris or anybody else in the group. There was this study from Johns Hopkins and Harvard. It found in the 16-year period of legalizing gay marriage, saw an immediate decline in the number of suicide rates for gay and lesbian high school students, a group in which attempted suicide is 2 to 7 times higher than heterosexual peers. I just was curious if you folks had seen any evidence of that, or how much of the suicide problem for young people might be connected with their sexual lifestyle.
Our LGBT population is a group of students in nationwide that are at higher risk of attempts and completions. Because of the culture of our nation, it's more spoken about, it's more highly accepted, even in public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I, hearing student voice, they're feeling more support. We have gay straight alliances in all of our secondary schools. That's for anyone, gay or straight, to come forward and join a community that they feel safe in. And I think that we're making great strides in trying to protect and support this particular group of students. I can't speak to the statistics.
Sure.
But I can tell you Spokane Public Schools has created policy and procedure to support transgender students, a very progressive thing.
Okay, Scott, briefly. Yeah,
real briefly, ahead. I just want to say I'm so glad we're having this discussion about, you know, our younger generation. You know, we see this in law enforcement where we're responding to suicides with young people, and the parents say, I had no idea that there was a problem. And so it's so important that we're having this discussion and that parents have that courageous conversation, as was mentioned, with their young people. Just a real quick statistics of the people that called the suicide prevention hotline last year in Idaho. 136 of them were between 10 and 14 years of age. And those are the ones that would give us that age. So it's a problem, and we need to make sure we're addressing it.
Okay. Let's, Quinn Bastian, can you come up for a moment? And so Quinn is with the Veterans Administration, and I know that I wanted to get somebody from the VA to come in. And so Quinn, thanks for showing up. And what is your actual title?
I am the chief of behavioral health for the local VA here in Spokane.
Okay. So could you maybe just give us a general idea of how big the suicide issue is for the VA? And I'm only basing that in part on when I, you know, did my initial call to the hospital to get information and connect with your public information officer. There, the options on the phone started with, you know, if you want to contact a staff member, press 1, and then it said, if you're contemplating suicide and want to talk to somebody, press 2. That was the very first thing on the phone.
Sure.
So,
well, thank you. And it's a privilege to be here and be part of the dialogue. You know, suicide is obviously a significant concern among our active duty service members and our veterans. We know that active duty service members and veterans are at elevated risk. We talked a little bit earlier about some of the rates, the suicide rates. And the fact of the matter is that those on active duty, and particularly our veterans, are at a higher level of risk for suicide. And so it is a key priority for the VA. This is not something that's just transient or political. It's across the last three administrations, the last three secretaries of the VA have all made initially reducing and now ending veteran suicide a top priority for the VA.
What have you seen a similar increase then with the patients that visit the VA hospital in Spokane? I mean, I don't know if you have figures or anything, but is this translated here locally too?
So I do. One thing that we know from the statistics, there's actually some really good research just in the last year, just in 2016, good research on the epidemiology and the changes in the risk factors for and in the rates for both active duty and veterans. So the risk for veterans has increased over the last 15 years by about 30%. We have not seen that same increase in risk, or at least the increase in the risks among our veterans here in Spokane. We have, in fact, seen a reduction in the numbers of suicide attempts and completions among Spokane veterans. Some of that can be just a matter of you know, frankly, the statistical noise. It could be that you know, any population has fluctuations around those numbers. We like to think that it has a lot to do with our intervention on behalf of our veterans. We'd like to take some credit for that, but we recognize that we certainly can't take, you know, all the credit for those reductions. That said, we've done some very hard work at the VA to do our best to intervene on behalf of our vets.
And so how do you work to identify the folks that may be at risk, other than the folks that are asking for help? That's the first question. Then maybe just give us kind of an overview of the counseling that's offered.
Sure. We have a number of initiatives to help out our veterans. So we've talked a little bit about crisis lines, and obviously the VA has an active crisis line, has for about 10 years now. Whenever somebody is identified as being at risk, that's one of the options for immediate help, is to connect them with the Veterans Crisis Line. As far as the process for identifying them, that ranges everywhere from somebody walking in the door to seeing their primary care provider to sitting in an appointment with a mental health clinician. All of our frontline staff, our receptionists, are trained in the same QPR gatekeeper training that some of our panelists have talked about, so that even though they may not be a clinician, they know some of the warning signs and know how to respond to help the veteran at that moment. In primary care, every veteran is asked some questions to understand a little bit if they might be at elevated risk for suicide. And then if a primary care provider identifies that there is increased risk, there's a process for helping them get to a mental health professional who can do a more thorough and complete risk assessment for suicide.
So they may routinely ask these kind of questions just at regular visits,
That's
is what
correct.
You're saying? Mm-hmm. And then the final thing I want to ask you too, and this may, you may not know the answer, but is there any role that prescribed drugs play in suicides for veterans? And I'm thinking in part because I had seen this Frontline piece on PBS about prescribed drugs in Iraq, and it was pretty intense. These guys were getting antidepressants followed by sleeping aids, and essentially they were just kind of drugged the entire time. At least the people in this particular piece were. I'm just wondering, is that a concern, or is that something you notice?
So I can't really speak to it. I've seen some of the same pieces, and I know that there is research being conducted about it, but certainly we don't have the data in yet to really understand what the impact is of some of those, the medical decisions that are made when somebody is out. And I think in your question you mentioned specifically in a combat setting,
right,
what the
exactly.
implications of that are, and what some of the fallout is, you know, down the road. One slightly different concern that we have seen, though, is we know that our active duty population, especially in our veterans here in, especially in the Inland Northwest, have higher rates of opiate use, of pain medications, than the general population, and even in some areas, other areas of the country among veterans. And there is an increased risk of suicide among veterans who are using high levels of opiate medication. So that's certainly something that we're paying attention to.
I think the final question for you would be, Do you think you need more resources in terms of counselors, just on the local level, because that's probably what you're most familiar with? Do you think there's a need that you could do a government request for that, or?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think we always struggle with what's the right amount, you know, what is the right number of counselors and psychiatrists and therapists that we have who can help out our patients. I think every VA will tell you they're a little short-staffed. I think every VA will say that. That said, we do have some tremendous resources at our VA, and particularly with our suicide prevention team. We have two full-time members and one part-time member of our team whose entire job is to focus on preventing suicide among our veterans and really being attentive to what the risks are, to both intervening personally and also helping through coaching and consultation and training to help other members of our teams to really engage with the veterans. So I'm very proud of our suicide prevention team. I think that they're doing an excellent job, and I don't think we're short-staffed in that regard.
Okay.
Always room for more help.
Okay. Quinn, thanks so much for coming down today. But I want to try to work my way through a few more of these questions. And again, I didn't have a chance to pre-read these, so I'm just pulling them out cold, and we'll see what they say. So here's one that says, what can be said to the survivors of those left behind? So often there is very large guilt burden. And I know that, Cheryl, you kind of talked about that, but it's a specific question. Do you want to maybe elaborate a bit more? Or
first and foremost is to listen. As we've all been saying, it's just the critical piece. Is to be available to listen. And then when you're with someone, there's often a lot of curiosity around suicide. How did it happen? What did they do? What did you see? And those are inappropriate questions. When people are grieving a loss due to suicide, they get very selective with who they want to share that information with. So you have to go very slowly with people and give them the opportunity to decide how much they're willing and wanting to share with you. And you may not be the person, even though you want to be there and be helpful, you may not be the person that they feel that they can talk to right then. So give people a lot of space, but also give people a lot of support. It's very awkward sometimes to know what to say. And I think one of the best things you can do is to just say, you know, I can't imagine what you must be feeling, but I want to be here for you in any way that I can. To offer yourself as a person that can be present, and then sit back and see if they respond to that. They may or they may not. When you're aware of a date, for instance, the death date of the person or the birth date of the person who died, or maybe it's Mother's Day and a child has died, or Father's Day, or even the regular holidays that we all honor. Try to be mindful that your friend is suffering during that time particularly. I remember at the time that my daughter died, I had four other children. And when Mother's Day came along, I didn't even feel like a mother because one of them was gone. So honor those dates if you can keep them on your calendar. And just send a gentle card or a phone call that says, I know it's a hard day for you, but I'm thinking about you. It can be so helpful. And then use the person's name that died. There's nothing sweeter than to hear that name spoken by another individual, because it tells you that they're not forgotten. So when you speak to them, don't be afraid to use the name of the person, and don't be afraid to bring their name up first, because the person who's grieving is always thinking about them. It's a forever journey. It's always there. And sometimes people run from that thinking, well, I don't want to bring up the name because it might make her cry, it might make him feel bad. It's the opposite. We want to hear about our loved one. And if you have a story that you can tell us, that's even better. Something to share. Try to be mindful that even though life moves forward, and you may think that person is moving forward because they're at their job and they're seemingly okay and they're doing their job and their work in a fashion that seems like everything's okay, it's still very much present and always will be. People make advances in their grief journey, but when you have this kind of grief, it's with you forever, like a new appendage on your body. It's always there. It gets a little easier with time, but it's always with you.
Okay, thanks, Cheryl, that was great. Here's a couple questions for the police chief, and I'll try to get these out pretty quick. And this is for Scott Hoke, can you take someone against their free will if they have attempted suicide, taking them to the hospital? Does that make sense? Do you get that part?
Yeah, it does, and I can speak for Idaho. I can't speak for Washington. I would assume it's the same in Washington.
Okay.
But if an officer responds to a situation and the officer feels like they're going to be a harm or a danger to themselves, then yes, they can take them against their will to a medical facility and hold them for a certain amount of time.
Okay, and here's a couple more for you. It says, do you believe the proximity to firearms on a daily basis contributes to the higher number of suicides among first responders and peace officers in particular? And I think you kind of talked about that already, but do you want to elaborate a bit?
Yeah, you know, we have seen, as I mentioned, a significantly higher suicide rate in law enforcement. I don't have the statistics to know whether it's firearms or what the means are. I mean, we know that firearms is a significant rate or is a significant factor in suicides. I know I was looking at some statistics in Idaho, just in Region 1, I think 60 of those suicides were by firearms. But anyways, I don't know for sure.
Okay. Here's an interesting one, and I hope I word this correctly. It says, I work with children in the mental health field. A theme I see very often seems to be social media related. And then it just says, the subject is vast, but are there any comments or resources available to parents? Probably dealing with just the social media field.
I think social media is a wonderful and terrible thing for us.
Yes.
Yeah.
It complicates our world, and it uncomplicates our world at the same time. For kids, remember that adolescents, if you ask adolescents what they most fear, they will say, I fear being invisible. So here we have social media. Here we have a kid, say, who feels socially awkward, alone, isolated, doesn't really know how to make friends, and when they try, they're rejected. And so they start feeling alone and powerless, which will lead to hopelessness. And then they find social media. And they find a way to communicate with people who, many of whom, will accept them because not for all sorts of reasons that may be other than appropriate. Or they may find people on social media that share their growing views of the world, which is dark, alone, alienation, and the potential is there becomes a melding of minds and a sharing of dark feelings that only serves to reinforce self-loathing, anger, rage. And then these kids come into the hospital and we wonder, what happened? What happened? And so much of their culture, those particular kids, has been social media and their access to like minds who are feeling as terrible as they are. So it's a wonderful thing. It's a terrible thing. My encouragement for parents always is to have these conversations with your kids about social media. Know what sites your kids are accessing and understand them. It's easy for me to say because, you know, my kids are older and I don't have to deal with Instagram and all that stuff. Yeah. But if I did have younger children, I would certainly educate myself and become competent in understanding these vehicles. They're not going away. We can't bar our children from this part of their culture, but we can understand it
And through understanding and information, we become more powerful. And we are joined with our kids in this part of their culture that is wonderful and horrible.
Okay, great. So Lou Sowers is a psychologist. Sorry, Lou. And you recently worked with our own Northwest News Network reporter, Austin Jenkins. He had done a special thing on prison suicide, and mm-hmm. I know your field of expertise is wide, but I just wanted to ask you a little bit about that today. So could you just tell us, I mean, what was the problem exactly, the extent of the problem? There was like a brief period where there was like a big spike in the suicide rate?
Yeah, in general, in the Washington State Department of Corrections, for example, we have 17,000 offenders on any given day. On a given year, we might have anywhere from 0 to 3 completed suicides. And we had a period of time where there was a substantial spike and we saw 11 completed suicides.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the challenges we were confronted with. And I think like our school district and our mental health center and other folks, we went to work and identified a number of strategies that we thought we could either improve or implement. And I think the good news is following a number of those interventions, suicide rates went back down. We in fact went over a year period with no suicides. But still have a lot of work to do.
And do we know, I mean, what was done to reduce this suicide rate? I understand that our own Airway Heights facility was actually a physical thing and had to do with access to a way that people could commit suicide. But was there just more counseling offered and more monitoring, or how did we reduce this rate?
Kind of a whole range of things. There are two ways to think about suicide prevention. There's the standard kind of mental health approach that let's detect somebody is at risk and then make sure that they have access to the services that are appropriate to their need. And the other way to think about it is what we call the public health approach, which is a means restriction approach. In realizing that most of the time a suicide crisis is going to last anywhere from 2 hours to 2 days. And there's some really good news in that, because when we can identify that somebody is at risk and we can keep them safe and we can get them past that 2-day mark, oftentimes we're going to do a whole lot to prevent suicides. And that's why, you know, Kevin had alluded earlier to kind of the gun access issue. And big issues for us in Washington State and Idaho have to do with whenever you're in a more rural, geographically isolated area, access to services, it's not going to be what it is, say, in a place like Seattle.
Right.
And so when folks don't have access to services and say they're depressed, they're feeling hopeless, whatever is going on, they may be in a situation for a longer period of time where they're getting worse, not better. And if you then think about the firearm access issue, anything that we can do to restrict means, and so I like to talk about firearm management. I don't like to get into the gun control kind of arguments, but anything that we can do to assure somebody doesn't have immediate access to the means to which they could use to end their lives is gonna help save lives. And that's no different in the Department of Corrections. If we figure out that folks have learned a easier way to hang themselves, for example, and we can do something to restrict that means, that's going to save lives.
Okay. Sorry, Lou, I'm going to stop you right there because I think I'm getting close in the time where we're going to wrap it up a bit. Now, Stacy, earlier in the week we talked about a possible success story. We weren't quite sure if somebody was going to be able to show up tonight, but I kind of would love to end this if we can talk to this person that you mentioned earlier, and maybe give me some background before we call them up just quickly. What or who are we talking to?
Sure, and I would just like to preface that I think that anyone who has some lived experiences with mental health, drug and alcohol, suicide attempts, you know, they are in a period of recovery as they move throughout their lives. And I think that most people would consider, you know, a suicide attempt survivor as a success, whether mm-hmm. you feel like it today or not, but that when you are alive, that is a success. We do have people in our community that we refer to as peer support specialists, and they are individuals with lived experiences, like I mentioned, with mental health or drug and alcohol, sometimes law enforcement interactions, oftentimes suicide attempts. And they're individuals that we partner with when we go out into the community, working with individuals that are in crisis or are in mental health treatment, and they can align with these individuals by sharing their own experiences and relate to someone in a way that maybe a mental health counselor cannot. And oftentimes engage someone and get them to a place where they might be willing to accept treatment or at least be interested in that, hearing more about it. And so that was a little bit about what we spoke about in terms of having someone here kind of present a little bit about their own experiences in their own story. And I just happened to see Laurel here in the audience and asked if she'd be willing to share a little bit about herself and kind of what her journey has been like and where she is at now.
Okay, can we get Laurel to come up? And Laurel, tell us, how did you find yourself in this situation at first? I mean, you were seriously considering taking your own life, or did you make an attempt? Or
yes. I'm Laurel, and I thank you for this forum. I thank you for the work that all of you people do. I really appreciate it. So I'm 46 years old, and I was diagnosed in 1990 with bipolar 2 disorder and seasonal affective disorder depression. Mm-hmm. In the year 2011, I suffered a severe relapse of bipolar depression mixed with agitation and anger. I became very suicidal, and it was, like we discussed here, a fluid and dynamic process of moving in and out of mood problems and the desire to end my life. I did have a significant biopsychosocial, environmental, all those factors were in play in my life. I had attempted a graduate studies program, and I achieved 2 years of that master's in social work, but I was unable to finish. I had a relapse in health. Uh-huh. I became hopeless, despairing. I was living in poverty. I couldn't work. I was intelligent, yet my brain was ill. I wondered about the quality of life in mind, body, spirit, socially, and financially. I wondered why in the spiritual aspect, why my good and loving and all-powerful God would create me and then allow me to be ill and not heal me. I wondered why my medications weren't working. I took quite a combination of medications over time, and mm-hmm. so a lot of things weren't going well. And I contemplated suicide a lot every day. I wanted to die. What I really wanted probably was my pain to die. I think I did value my life in some aspect. I do believe in the sanctity of my life, my human life. But I was in so much pain, and having dealt with this illness for so long, it was difficult. So the Spokane Mental Health, now Frontier Behavioral Health, the crisis response team came to my home. They were alerted by some friends of mine that I was suicidal. Two police officers, two designated mental health professionals, one pastor, and two ambulance guys showed up in my living room. I was taken involuntarily to Holy Family Hospital, read my rights like a criminal, and then I was boarded in an ER room for several days until a bed opened up on the acute psych ward at Sacred Heart Hospital. Then I got help that I needed mm-hmm. at the time. I received ECT treatments, which are electroconvulsive therapy, that was very effective in helping my depression. I had a medication change. I had people who listened to me. Listening is a huge, huge part of this puzzle. And people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So when people just start talking at you with advice, that doesn't help.
What advice can you give to somebody? You've been through this. Can you maybe
I truly have.
What kind of advice could you give to somebody who now is maybe in the same situation you were in before?
The person who wrote the card tonight also, I would say recovery is possible. I live a full, meaningful life now. I have found treatments that work.
And are you are also doing counseling too?
Oh, absolutely. Now I'm not a professional counselor. I'm
right.
trained as a peer support specialist, but I'm not working in that capacity at this time. I'm a member of the Evergreen Club, which is a program through Frontier Behavioral Health. I serve on the Trauma Informed Care Domain 2 committee with FBH, and I also am with the Consumer Voice Choice and Advocacy as a part of Trauma Informed Care. And I do participate in the CIT training at the Evergreen Club, giving my personal story to officers and first responders.
What do you think of your therapy was the thing that was the most useful that you went through? I mean, you talked about this electroshock kind of thing, but what were the other things, or I should say, what were the most important things that helped you the most, do you think?
My family held hope for me when I didn't have it. The professional people in my life cared about me and held value and hope for me when I had none. Hopelessness is the hallmark of depression, and I had no hope. People loved me. People cared about me. People listened. I'm able to speak now on behalf of people with severe and persistent mental illness to say that recovery is possible. Recovery is not necessarily cure. There is no cure for this illness. It's a major mental illness. My brain has a biological vulnerability, but with medication, I learn to dance with this illness. It's my dance partner daily. I dance with bipolar, and I respect my dance partner. I respect my recovery. It's possible. Recovery does happen. It takes courage and hard work. Our main program administrator at Evergreen Club said recently at Open House, recovery is not for sissies. It takes tremendous courage, and it takes a lot of work. And these folks here, you know, I understand why somebody wants to die. Believe me, I said to my doctor, just give me a lethal injection. Put me out of my misery. And he said, your life is valuable. Things can get better. And that's really what I have found to be true.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. And I
You're
hope
welcome.
that your testimony has at least provided some inspiration to the folks that maybe either in our audience here or listening on the air.
Yes. And thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you. And I want to thank Ray. Thank you for listening to our annual health forum here on Spokane Public Radio on suicide awareness. It is my hope that we've been able to provide some answers for those who may need help with their lives and their family members and friends, and that we have been able to make a difference in at least one person's life tonight. We'd like to thank our panelists, Stacy Cornwell, Scott Haug, Dr. Kevin Hyde, Cheryl Shepherd, and Arlene Hinckley. Also the sub-panelists that got up and spoke in the audience, Dr. Lou Sowers, Quinn Bastian, and Chris Moore. And we'd also like to thank our event donors, Providence Healthcare, Kauffman and Associates, Washington State University Health Sciences Spokane, and the Journal of Business, and of course, our partner, City Cable 5. Also thanks to our Spokane Public Radio staff members and volunteers who have helped out tonight. Thanks so much.
We've received support for this forum from the Journal of Business, the Inland Northwest source for local healthcare industry news, serving the local business community in print, online, and on the go, SpokaneJournal.com. Kauffman & Associates, a Native American consultant firm specializing in event coordination, multimedia product design, research, and organizational consultation, details at KauffmanInc.com. Providence Healthcare, serving the region for generations through knowledge, skills, and experienced caregivers dedicated to helping create healthier communities together. Information at phc.org. And WSU, opening the state's second public medical school with the first 2 years of education in Spokane. More at spokane.wsu.edu. It was moderated by Steve Jackson.